This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Natsu Saito about her new book titled Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law. Hear how the United States has violated international law since its Declaration of Independence. We'll hear excerpts from a recent panel about the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court of the United States.
How fast can Obama move the court to the right? Elena is on her way.
Stay with us. Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law, is the title of Natsu Saito's recent book. Natsu is an attorney and professor of law at Georgia State University's College of Law in Atlanta. The book boldly points out how the United States has violated international law since its Declaration of Independence. As often discussed here on Law and Disorder, international courts and institutions have been at the forefront of holding the torture conspirators accountable. Meeting the Enemy gives disturbing insight into the origins of American exceptionalism. Natsu joins us in the studio today. She teaches international law and human rights, race in the law, immigration, criminal procedure, and professional responsibility. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Natsu.
Thank you.
You may know that in the National Lawyers Guild, we encourage our litigators to cite international treaties that this country has signed when bringing civil rights and other claims. And practitioners rarely do this. Your new book, Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law, provides readers with a historical backdrop and really quite succinctly the reason why this country thinks itself exempt from international treaties. In a nutshell, why don't we adhere to the obligations to which other countries are bound?
Well, the why addresses a lot of different levels. To me, one of the interesting things about looking at United States compliance with international law is the duality that on the one hand, the United States does exempt itself very consistently and very frequently, and yet promotes international law very strongly and relies upon it for its legitimacy. And it's that contradiction that I think is both really interesting and telling, but also gives us the room in which to insist that international law be complied with, because the United States has recognized from the beginning of its history that it has no legitimacy if it's not legitimately a state and a international law complying state. And so I think that's sort of the positive benefit of international law and the role it can play. Now, the United States has exempted itself, as you said, very consistently. And in order to do that within that context, to say that international law is still important, yet in this instance, in that instance, the United States doesn't have to comply with it, it has relied upon certain premises that are fundamental to the whole outlook and paradigm of colonialism, which is that there is a higher good, a more civilized approach that the United States embodies. And it's only by constructing that dichotomy between the civilized and the other that the United States and other colonial powers can justify, well, the law is important and the law applies to everyone, except here it doesn't need to apply in its specifics because we have a higher aim of furthering civilization, and that justifies not playing by the rules under this particular circumstance.
And the issue of rogue states, and you talk a bit about pluriverse. It's rather stunning when one goes back, as you have done, to the colonial days and how that paradigm has continued consistently through history and how people don't seem to challenge it. Why is that?
I think fundamentally it's because we still have a colonial order. If you start to challenge the history and acknowledge colonialism and the problems with colonialism historically, you've got to address them as they manifest today. And that is something that makes people very uncomfortable, makes certain people, makes those who benefit or perceive themselves to benefit from colonialism uncomfortable.
In that, you talk about how the United States concept is to see
virtually one path to what they call human progress, and that's Western civilization and American values. After World War II, we sort of entered the era of the United Nations and international standards. Interestingly, we lost our seat on the UN Human Rights Commission in 2001, you mentioned, for the first time since 1947. Is that because we were seen by other countries as being hypocrites?
Definitely. And it is the United States' insistence that others comply with these human rights standards while exempting itself that has made a lot of the other states and governments of the world at least irritated. And I think that was a statement that, you know, you can't put rules on us that you're not playing by yourself. I want to get back to what you said about rogue states for a minute, because I think that one of the most fundamental problems in the international order as it's generally understood right now is that international law is seen as the law between states. And in the sort of pre-decolonization era, states, there were criteria for what was a recognized state. And in order to be a recognized state, you had to be civilized according to Euroderivative standards. And as long as they had that sort of filter, who gets to be a state and who doesn't, then the rules could be decided upon by the, quote, civilized or colonizing states. What has happened to some extent since then is that the rest of the world has been divided up into states, but these states have been very arbitrarily imposed along colonial lines, completely ignoring the distinction between states and nations or peoples. And by virtue of forcing everyone to participate in the international arena through the mechanism of a state government, that has stifled what I consider to be real potential for liberation in the notion of self-determination. But it has also caused a problem for the, quote, civilized states, because since everyone is a state now, or all of the land masses and peoples of the world have been assigned to states, there is a problem in applying this sort of civilized versus other standard. And so now what we see is that certain states, when they don't behave in accordance with the larger project of furthering Western civilization, are now deemed to be rogue states. So that's really sort of an othering of those peoples, but through the mechanism of states.
It's so interesting in all the talk about uncivilized rogue states, when one reads your book and looks at the United States' behavior and the creation of fake terms that it uses to justify different actions, a war on terrorism, for example, the so-called war on terrorism, the obvious conclusion is that we are the ultimate rogue state, living by really made-up laws to justify perpetrating murders and invasions and taking over countries and ruining civilizations all around the world.
I think that's why the notion of a unilinear history, progress in the very Western sense of that word, moving humanity toward on this one path towards this higher goal is so critical, because if you strip that away and you just look at the realities on the ground, you see that what has been termed Western civilization has been incredibly barbaric, very destructive, destructive of the planet, destructive of peoples all around the world, destructive of cultures. And in order to get around that analysis, you have to say, well, it was for a higher good. And that's why if we channel all analyses into this one, you know, there is progress and progress proceeds along this one path, and we define, you know, they define what defines the ultimate good and the ultimate goal, then you can just, they purport to justify these very horrendous, barbaric, inhuman practices and ultimately practices that are destructive of the entire planet in terms of, you know, you have to make some sacrifices for this greater good.
What would you say is your biggest critique of the left as a whole, and how does it fit into your writing and researching this book?
I think that the left tends to accept the general framework and to make particular criticisms of policies and practices that are obviously problematic. U.S. government engaging in torture, for example. That's clearly wrong. It's clearly illegal. It's clearly a violation of international law, et cetera, et cetera. But each instance is accepted as somewhat anomalous rather than seeing the larger patterns. And I believe that that is in large measure because even those folks on the left in the United States are unwilling to really deal with the implications that this is, it was, and continues to be a colonial power. It is too frightening even for people on the left to deal with the reality. This is a country that sits on occupied land, illegally occupied by its own rules, not by the rules of the peoples whose land it is, but by the United States rules, by the rules of international law, by the rules of Euro-derivative law. It is an illegal occupation. And even people on the left, they want to fix, they want to make it a kinder, gentler colonialism. And they are not willing to really go there, which I think is really interesting because I always tell my students when dealing with these types of issues, you know, you can free your mind, right? Even if all of us in this room decide that this is illegal, wrong, completely unfounded in terms of its own standards, nothing is going to change, right? It will only change if we then do something about that conclusion. But there's no reason you can't free up your mind to be honest and to stop being in denial at some level. And I think the left hangs on to that denial. You know, we want to fix it. We want to make it a more equitable. We want there to not be racial discrimination and gender discrimination and sexual orientation discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. But still based on the foundations that are established by this hegemonic colonial power. And I don't think we can have it both ways.
What kinds of responses do you get from your students? Is there apathy toward the way things are? Do you have activist-type students?
The most common reaction, I think, is anger that they have not been taught real history. I get a lot of, why has nobody ever told me this? Why wasn't I taught this in grade school and high school? And, you know, why does nobody ever talk about this? Beyond that, there is, of course, a whole range of folks who are angry at having their denial poked at. And there are folks who feel very liberated by saying, you know, I know there's something wrong here, and this is helping me start to get some kind of handle on it, some kind of framework. And I do have a lot of wonderful activists, students who really want to go out and make a difference.
Well, I'm sure that you weren't happy to hear about the Texas changes to the textbooks that they're making down there.
This is true. Those of us who are old enough to remember the 60s and 70s remember what a struggle that we went through. Struggle to collectively, I'm not taking credit for that, but to try to expand what history meant, to expand, to include everyone's story, to include the stories of communities of color and peoples around the world. You know, we thought that possibly we had at least started that process of opening it up, of putting some cracks in the hegemonic history. But in a certain sense, I was kind of relieved to see what was happening in Texas, because what has happened, I think, since we started opening up, getting ethnic studies program, getting Black studies, American Indian studies, et cetera, that history was very quickly assimilated into the mainstream narrative, right? All of a sudden, Dr. King was not, quote, the most dangerous Negro in America. He was the one who wanted us all to be nice and calm and light candles and sing songs and never do anything disruptive, which was, of course, a complete betrayal of his actual legacy and history. But that's the way, you know, it had been incorporated into the textbooks. It had been sanitized and essentially made to further the larger hegemonic project. And so in a way, I'm sort of happy to see a bit of honesty come back into that process. I think it's much easier when you can tell your children what they are teaching you in school is this one particular perspective, and you have to be conscious of all these other perspectives and see it in that light. That's much easier than when in school they're saying, oh, look, we're telling everybody's story. That's a much more confusing narrative.
We're talking with Natsu Taylor Saito about her new book, Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law. It's so thoroughly researched, yet so readable. You really are a beautiful writer. How long was this in the works?
Oh, about 6 years. Had a few other projects in the meantime, but it took a while. And I started out thinking that I was writing a book about the United States' failure to comply with international law and why, sort of arguments for why it was important to comply with international law. And it would have been a very different book at that point. As I got into it, I realized that the more interesting questions were the push-pull dynamic between reliance on international law, very deep, fundamental reliance, and failure to comply with international law, and why that disconnect seems so palatable to most, you know, intelligent, thinking, concerned people. So as I got into those questions, it got more complex and more interesting. And the other thing that I really had to struggle with was the fact that international law, as we know it today, is a construct, is a system that derives from European colonial encounters. And so even though it has changed and opened up in ways that I think make it a very important tool for creating a world which is possibly sustainable, possibly more just, we still have to address the contradictions within international law itself. I mean, it was the law initially. Our current system of international law evolved from the international law, which was the agreement between the European colonial powers of how they were not going to destroy each other in the process of taking over the rest of the world, and the agreements that they came to, and the systems that they developed for working that out. And those dynamics still permeate international law to a great extent. And so we have to be aware of those, too. It's not enough just to say, well, international law is the solution.
I know that you've written and thought a lot about the Bush administration and the 2001 attacks and how the resulting anti-terrorism laws have really sent a cloud of repression over this country and other countries. Do you think that the unlawful and outrageous conduct of the Bush administration continued to the present administration, using the fear of terrorism to really act lawlessly in a more blatant way, do you think that will facilitate readers of your book sort of understanding and seeing more sharply the theses that you write about?
I hope so. I think so. And the reason I think so is because in order to do what has been done in this so-called war on terror, those carrying out the war, particularly in the U.S. administrations, both the Bush and the Obama administration, have had to resort to the characterization of the other as uncivilized, as savage. The rules don't apply because they're not playing by the rules. They don't play by the rules. Therefore, we don't have to play by the rules either. And this is a theme that goes all the way back, right? It goes back to the Crusades. It goes back to the colonization of Africa. It goes back to the United States' relations with American Indian nations. That is the consistent theme, and the Philippines war and the war in Vietnam. I mean, we could go on and on, Mexico, right? But consistently, that is the sort of the rabbit that's pulled out of the hat, right? The rules apply to those who are civilized. If you are not civilized, those rules do not apply. If you do not comport with the goals of Western colonialism, you are by definition not civilized. So it's a very handy little loop. And I think that the fact that they're articulating it so clearly in the War on Terror makes it easier to see the connections and the patterns.
And you do talk throughout the book about the other. And it's so true that I hesitate to use the word war, as you know, because we have effectively demonized a concept, that of terror, and used that to justify any number of unlawful, even torturous actions against not only individual countries, but individuals and actions that we can fit into that rubric with really no parameters.
Yes. No, it's a very dangerous, I think, that that has become accepted as a war. And we saw that, you know, the war on crime, the war on drugs. Everybody knows that when you call – when something is a war, there are different rules apply. Now, the fact is there are fairly clearly stated rules, laws that apply to war that are not being complied with either. But it gets it into that area where people accept more readily that some of the day-to-day civilian life, civil liberties, et cetera, may not be as strictly adhered to in if it's a war. There are many problems with that construction. But by calling it a war in such a vague way, anything goes. And we see this, I mean, in something as simple and basic as the battles that have been fought politically over what do we call Wounded Knee, right? Was it a battle or was it a massacre? You know, by calling it a battle, it becomes a war, and therefore, of course, people get killed in wars. You know, the fact that they go in and mow down women and children and old people and civilians, right, that doesn't go down so well. But if you call it a battle, you call it a war, then it makes it easier to remain in denial. I think all of this really is not about the truth of the matter so much as about what makes it easier to stay in denial and therefore allow the status quo to roll on.
Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law by Natsu Taylor Saito, New York University Press. It's really an important addition with all the other books that are out there, Natsu. You've, I think, identified a broader theme that really helps explain hundreds and thousands of injustices that we see this country perpetrating from the original Native Americans to other countries all around the world who we vilify and call uncivilized. We urge readers to read this wonderful book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We go now to hear from the speakers at the Brecht Forum in a program sponsored by Law and Disorder on Elena Kagan and the Supreme Court. We will hear from Marty Garbus, who's argued before the Supreme Court many times, who's litigated cases in every district in this country, who's written 5 books, including the main book on the Supreme Court. We'll hear also from Margaret Ratner Kunstler, the former educational director at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a leader of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And finally, we will hear from a young practicing attorney, Anand Swaminathan, who was a law student at Harvard Law School, started the same year as Elena Kagan started as the dean there. I'd like to introduce our moderator, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who will be introducing the other two speakers and speaking first. Margaret is a criminal defense lawyer and real estate lawyer here in New York City. She's the past educational director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and she is presently the president of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, named after her late husband, William Kunstler. Margaret, thank you for taking over as moderator of the program on Elena Kagan.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here on this warm summer evening. I think we have a great opportunity here to learn a lot about Ms. Kagan. We have someone who is an expert on constitutional law, Martin Garbus, who has worked in the courts, has written about the courts, and really is someone who can fill us in about what Elena Kagan has to offer and what the situation with the court is now. We also have someone, Anand Swaminathan, who actually got an opportunity to meet Elena Kagan and to spend some time with her. So we have both the professional analysis and the personal analysis, which gives us really an opportunity to learn something about her. I really became interested in this nomination only as a result of Elena Kagan's argument in the humanitarian rights case. Because to me, what she did there was either Faustian or low-level soap opera. I'm not quite sure what. But when you analyze her First Amendment analysis there, where she said that teaching international law and teaching alternatives to violence was action and not First Amendment protected speech, was even beyond what the most reactionary people on this court had to say. So we have this woman who speaks in front of her future colleagues and is challenged by the women on the Supreme Court and surprised. She definitely surprised them with what she had to say. She went so far as to say, not only were teaching these things not protected by the First Amendment because they were not speech, she went on to explain, when challenged, that an attorney arguing for an amicus brief for a group that was on this terrorist list was also in violation of the Patriot Act. So we're at an extreme situation, and I what I'm wondering here is my cynical analysis correct? Did she do this because everybody figured out that this would save her appointment to the Supreme Court, or did she do it for another reason? And that's my question to the panelists. Anand, do you want to start? And you don't have to obviously answer that question first, but I'd love to hear the answer to that question.
Well, let me start with during the first 3 years of her deanship at Harvard Law School. So I'll just give you a couple just basic anecdotes about those first few years. And there's no question that there was a general sense that Harvard Law School was a place that wasn't all that student-friendly in its past until the time that Dean Kagan was there. And once she was there, she was very, very popular with the student body at the law school. And if you ask students why she was popular, why they liked her, the reasons are a little bit amusing. I mean, she instituted a free coffee in front of the lecture halls policy that the students loved. She had free tampons in the women's bathrooms. She now famously put in an ice rink and a volleyball court outside of the student commons. And you can legitimately poll students and ask them, did you like Kagan? And they'll say yes. And if you ask them why, the first thing they'll say, sort of jokingly, is the coffee. And then there won't really be anything else. I mean, I think those are kind of things that really did ingratiate her with the students. But I think that is what it is. And we can query whether or not that says something about the student population at Harvard and how you can buy them off or whatever else it is. But there's a second thing, which is that I was heavily involved with public interest programs and clinical programs at Harvard. There's no question that she was very actively involved in promoting those programs. And she did increase funding for public interest programs and clinical programs at Harvard. And she went one step further, which was that whenever at least the programs that I was involved with had a recruiting event or some fundraising event, and we asked her to come and speak to the students who we were trying to have join our organizations, she would do that. And I probably heard her speak 15, 20, 30 times during the course of law school, because she would come to all of these organizational events in the evenings and give some speech. And it did matter when you had a very popular dean come and support these clinical programs and these public interest programs and say good things about them. So I think all of that is to say that I think those things may make a very good case for her as a great dean and a great dean of that law school. I don't think they say anything about her as a potential good Supreme Court justice. That's where I want to just make a few brief comments and then maybe pass it on to others who can speak more intelligently about these things. But I think that when I say a good justice, I mean someone who is going to be a progressive justice, someone who's going to have views and uphold certain ideals, who is going to be that kind of person? And there's kind of a debate in a mainstream sort of in the public that talks about a left on the court and a right on the court, and a progressive wing and a conservative wing, or a liberal wing and a conservative wing. And I think that's a very misleading debate, and I just want to highlight that. I don't think necessarily people in this room may be necessarily looking at it or characterizing it that way, but I think that's a debate that's a way the conversation is had that I think is very misleading and has to be, we should at least address that. And I'll just point out a couple statistics that I thought were at least sort of striking, and I think explain how we do not have anybody progressive whatsoever on the Supreme Court. The Chambers of Commerce of the United States, which is the pro-business advocacy group in Washington, which is very powerful, filed 16 amicus briefs in the last Supreme Court term. They won on 13 of those cases. So 13 out of 16, 81% of the cases that they filed amicus briefs in, their position won in front of the Supreme Court. I think that's a higher winning percentage than soon-to-be Justice Kagan had as Solicitor General Kagan in front of the Supreme Court.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Go now to hear from the speakers at the Brecht Forum in a program sponsored by Law and Disorder on Elena Kagan and the Supreme Court.
So the business lobby was more effective than Kagan was even as a Solicitor General of the United States in front of the Supreme Court. I think that says something about the justices, and those were not all 5-4 decisions. So I think that says something about the Supreme Court. I think there's a principle that I think that comes from that also applies across the entire federal bench. I mean, another statistic that I thought was very powerful is that there are 162, and this statistic I think is about a year old, but someone had done a study and looked at the backgrounds of all of the federal court of appeals judges in the United States, and there are 162 of them. And 5 out of 162 court of appeals judges in the United States had a public interest career of any sort whatsoever. And that doesn't include working in government or maybe serving on a board of a nonprofit, an actual public interest career of any sort, 5 out of 162 federal judges. So I think these are things that give us some suggestions about whether or not there really is anybody progressive in the judiciary. There may be some, but certainly not on the Supreme Court. I think one other place that I think is worth just considering because of the conversation is one of the most recent decisions from the Supreme Court, the Citizens United case, against the Federal Election Commission case, which had to do with the campaign finance reform bill. And that has been a hot topic recently, and I think that's an interesting case. I mean, Justice Stevens wrote a strong dissent. It was a 5-4 decision. And there's no question he wrote a strongly worded dissent from that decision. But really, the debate in that case between the 5 justices in the majority and the 4 justices, the 4 liberal justices in the dissent, was about whether or not there was a compelling governmental interest in that specific instance regarding that specific provision for the restrictions the government was placing on speech. But the fundamental legal fiction, which is that corporations are persons with constitutional rights, was not a debate at all. 9 justices agreed about that point. And I think that's at least an example of this notion that we should not talk about this court in general as being one with a set of conservatives and a set of progressives. So I just wanted to make that point. And I think the next sort of logical question is, well, then what does a progressive justice look like? Who is an ideal justice? What is the constitutional interpretation? What kind of constitutional interpretation will we have from a progressive justice? And I think that's a question that that I have that I'd also like to, that maybe we can talk about.
I think Judge Kagan has shown herself to be a good soldier. She has shown herself as someone who'll do what she has to do to get ahead. And she took a position in that case which upheld the government statute. As to whether or not her position is arguable, remember that Stevens, at least in that case, even swung over to her side. So it's a case which is in many ways can be seen as easier, although it's a very hard case, and although it's wrongly decided, at least she also pulled in Stevens in what was the 63 decision. I think the Citizens United case is perhaps the most important case in the last 10 years. And I think the analysis that we heard is the beginning of a discussion. I think the Citizens United case, along with Bush against Gore, are the two bookends that totally describe this court. The substantive argument, at least the argument in the case, went on with respect to the extent to which money by corporations can influence elections. And by and large, the majority took the position that money does not influence elections. It took the position that, therefore, you had to give money a kind of protection that was equal to speech. The dissent came up with a very different position. And Stevens' dissent, which was discussed, goes at great length to discuss the different ways in which corporations use money. It goes into PAC monies, direct monies, expenditures. What the case dealt with, basically, was the use of corporate funds with respect to expenditures. So as, for example, the Swift boat or the Hillary Clinton movie. And it basically said that in those areas, the corporations could not be limited with respect to the spending of money. To think that that doesn't totally affect or sway a, quote, democracy is just being totally unrealistic. So I think that one of the issues in the case, as Lenny Weinglass said before to me, it's a question of putting some kind of principle over reality when you deal with the effect of money. And I think one could talk about that case solely as showing you the kind of court you have, the kind of values that are being discussed, and the kinds of conclusions that the court comes to.
Let me just expand on that really briefly, because it is very, very interesting in the context of the discussion that the court is having in that case. It struck me as a case that really touched on potentially some of the answers to the question that I had posed at the end of my last turn speaking about what kind of constitutional interpretation would we want from a progressive justice. It's a case in which and I hadn't fully appreciated this because I don't have a very significant First Amendment background whatsoever. So it probably was less surprising to you, but for me, I did not realize that there was a decision from approximately 20 years ago, the Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce case, in which the court basically takes a view, which this court in the Citizens United case calls the anti-distortion principle. And what this court calls the anti-distortion principle is basically a view that vast accumulations of wealth or vast accumulations of capital can distort the political process. And let me just sort of, what the Austin case says, Austin found a compelling governmental interest in preventing, quote, the corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form and that have little or no correlation to the public support for the corporation's political ideas. That is expressly what the majority rejects in the Citizens United case. And what's interesting is they reject it specifically on what are essentially free market principles. All right, and the court repeatedly goes back to notions of Austin interferes with the, quote, open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. They talk about ideas, quote, may compete in the marketplace without governmental interference, and so on. And so, to me, what was striking is that this free market sort of ideology that we see pervasive throughout the sort of economic dialogue in this country, especially in the context of the what's been going on with this recent recession and so on, is that is actually, to some degree, is playing out in the First Amendment context. And that was, to some degree, a little bit of a surprise to me. The other thing that's interesting as well is that Justice Roberts writes a concurring opinion here in which he takes this anti-distortion principle, the notion that vast accumulations of wealth can distort the political process, and he calls it something in the pejorative. That is, he calls it an equality principle. And he says, look at this. Third, this is Justice Roberts now, the Austin decision is uniquely destabilizing because it threatens to subvert our court's decisions even outside the particular context of corporate express advocacy. And what he calls it then is he says, Austin's logic would authorize government prohibition of political speech by a category of speakers in the name of equality. And he goes on to say, this is the worst thing ever. Okay, so I think that is a very interesting, I think it sets up an interesting debate. And Stevens, in his dissent, and he writes a very strong dissent, actually makes it a point to distance himself from the notion that the anti-distortion principle is an equality principle. He says, no, 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 it's not about equality. It's about these other things, and it's still important. And I think that that little sort of interplay is very interesting. And I think that's something that is maybe worth discussing.
I just want to make one point, which is perhaps something different. And that is the way the court went out and seized this case in order to fundamentally rewrite the law. As has been pointed out, there had been a case called Austin back in 1990, which had decided the issue the other way. And then there's a Supreme Court case in 2003 called McConnell, which again had decided the law the other way. So here the court now is, in this year, going out, taking a case where you have precedent, very clear precedent, and they then reverse that precedent. What they also do, and one of the questions about what should a progressive judge be, there are procedures set up with respect to when you take a case, when you don't take a case, what state the case should be in when you take it. We all know that a lot of that is just often rhetoric, the accusation being that the other side shouldn't have taken the case, where you defend a position where you shouldn't have taken. But this is a case where there's no conceivable way, no conceivable argument, why the court should have taken this case in the posture that it was taken. So here you not only had a court reaching out to decide an issue the wrong way, but they reached out so far. Since 1907, the United States Supreme Court has discussed the whole question of money and speech. And with what Justice Stevens does in his decision, where he talks about Austin and where he talks about McConnell, is he looks at the law of the last 100 years, where there have been consistent positions aware of the effect of corporate money on the democratic process. And then that is just totally disregarded by the majority in the case. So the case is interesting because for those people who had views that the Supreme Court was not that political, there's a professor named Ronald Dworkin who writes, for amongst other places, the New York Review of Books, who for many, many years took the position that the Supreme Court of the legal system was not that political. He got his mind changed ultimately to Bush against Gore. And now again, with this case, he's again started to write on it, and any illusion he had, this is a respected professor now in his late 70s, has been pierced by this case plus Bush against Gore as to the inherent political nature of the legal system.
You know, when Roberts appeared before Congress and was questioned about how he'd be a judge, Roberts said, you know, as a judge, I just call the balls and strikes. The assumption being that there are precedents, take the facts, you take the precedents, you apply the precedents to the facts, and you come down with a decision. That's precisely what they did not do in the election case, where they said that corporations are persons, therefore they should be allowed to give as much money as they want to in a particular political cause. Why did they decide that? Why did they overturn the past precedent that Marty cited? And why did they do that? It brings to mind Justice Stevens' comment that when he was appointed to the Supreme Court 30 years ago, everybody that followed him in the last 30 years was more to the right than he was, with the possible exception of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That the court has gone further to the right over three decades. So I think we all have to ask ourselves the question, why is this so? And what are the underlying causes in this society that's fashioning one of the main political bodies in the United States? And I wanted to raise that without answering it, at least not at this point, and ask Marty and Margie and Anand what their thinking is on that question.
What you've had is a Rehnquist court, which started in the early 1980s. And you now have the Roberts Court. Assuming the Roberts Court goes on for 10 to 15 years. The next person who steps down is probably Ruth Ginsburg, assuming Obama is in, whether or not he gets a nomination or not. It may not be, but you have a solid majority of 5-4. There's every reason to believe it's going to stay for a while. So you've had now straight 30 years of the Rehnquist Court. You may have another 20 years of the Roberts Court. That would be 50 years in a stretch. Nothing like that has ever existed before in the United States. You had the Roosevelt Court for a period of time. You had the Warren Court for a period of time. You had a long conservative court at the turn of the century called the Lochner era. But nothing has ever happened like this. So the whole political process has basically winnowed out the Thurgood Marshalls of the world. Even someone like Kagan more or less distances herself from it. The possibilities of getting in a true progressive judge, given the politics right now, seem to be very, very difficult and probably won't happen in many generations to come. So you're going to have a Supreme Court. I mean, there's no question that this is a business court. The decision in the Citizens United case is a pure business decision. It purely favors business interests. There's no there can be no thought otherwise. So if you look at what's happened over the last 800 years of Supreme Court appointments, you can just see that this is a pattern. The other side is more passionate about their candidates. Their candidates get in. You can get someone like Alito through. You can get someone like Roberts through. Whereas the Democrats, or that side, certainly is not going to get anybody with that kind of zeal or fervor. I mean, that's the reality of the United States Supreme Court politics. Also, what happened back about 1980, the Federalist Society was formed within the legal world. And that the Federalist Society were basically conservative groups. They sprouted out in the law schools, and they became, if you will, seed for the people that ultimately finished up in the district courts and the circuit courts. And if you were to look at the political balance now of the circuit courts and district courts, what you see that it's preponderantly very conservative. And since many of the Supreme Court justices come from the circuit courts, then you're going to see the same kind of judges coming from those courts.
I think that what you said, Marty, just nailed it. It's a business court, has been for 30 years, and looks like it's going to be for at least another 20. And that raises the question of what kind of forces are at play that call for this kind of a business court to protect American business. I think anybody in the audience could just as easily substitute for anybody up here, with the exception, I think, of Marty, who really knows what he's talking about.
The question is that if you support a group listed as terrorist organizations, even if you only support their most progressive non-terrorist aspects, such as doing lessons in non-lethal activities and how to resolve things without force resulting to force or violence, yes, you may be prosecuted under the law as a supporter of terrorist activities. He would have to be indicted, and not everybody is indicted. That's the key here. It's a lot of discretion about who gets indicted for what. You would be indicted and he wouldn't be.
The two decisions that come to mind on that principle of material support for terrorism, in addition to the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, which you're referring to, which was a terrible decision. And that was the decision that Elena Kagan, our next Supreme Court Justice, argued as Solicitor General. That was a brief that was submitted to the Supreme Court that she signed. And she took the position that this Humanitarian Law Project, that was consulting with the Kurdish Workers Party about how to bring about peaceful change in their country, that was material aid to terrorism, on the basis that whatever they did could have saved the Kurdish Workers Party, and they therefore could have taken the saved money and gone out and done terrorist stuff with it. And it was all based on the ability of the American government to decide who they pick as a terrorist. Hamas, for example, they've said is a terrorist, and now any relations with Hamas, you better be careful. For example, the head of the Holy Land Fund, the largest Muslim charity in America, got sentenced to 65 years in prison. He's in Marion Penitentiary in maximum security as we're talking. What did this gentleman do? he raised money for Palestinian families who had been displaced with their homes blown up, money for Palestinian children to go to college, money for Palestinian children to receive medical care, and so on. All he did was raise money and sign checks and send it over to people he thought who were in need. And the government got him for material aid for terrorism because they designated the organizations to whom he was signing checks as terrorist organizations. Therefore, he was supporting terrorism. A lot of organizations, including NGOs in America, supported these same organizations. They didn't prosecute them, but they selectively prosecuted Hassan Alisha, and they sent him to prison for 65 years, materially supporting terrorism. That's the same charge they got Lynn Stewart on, because she issued a press release. And that, they figured, was the material support of a terrorist organization, which they had denominated as a terrorist organization. It's a very scary tool that they've developed, which, in my opinion, they're going to use against the movements for social change here in the United States. I think that's the question that concerns all of us. We've seen the kind of laws that have been put into practice starting with the Bush administration in September and November of 2001, right after the attacks. They used military law domestically so that the president could denominate anybody as a terrorist organization and declare war on him. And they declared war on Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda is not a country, but they declared war on a political organization. And the principle of that is very scary, because they could declare a domestic organization as a terrorist organization and goodbye democratic rights. I think the question we're all concerned about is what kind of decisions this current Supreme Court, with the addition of Elena Kagan, who's shown no hope for us, at least so far, but what kind of decisions they'll make, and questions like that that would be used sometime down the future in the United States. And I'll end with just one point. You've seen what happened in Greece. There have been 7 general strikes in Greece in the last several months. The excuse has been is that the Greek people are living too high off the hog, that they've spent too much in the past, that their standard of living has to be reversed. They've lowered their wages by 20%, which is what caused the general strikes. And the percentage of debt that Greece has relative to their gross national product is the same percentage of debt that you have in the United States. And you have now, in discussions in elite circles, what they can do about lowering the standard of living of people here in the United States. And if there is some kind of fight back, which there inevitably will be, here, just like there was in Greece, and these questions go to the courts, what are the courts going to do about it? That's something that concerns me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.